Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I will be very quick because there is a lot going on in the world right now, and I will talk to you more about some of that stuff in the next couple of months because, what I do for a living, the thing that I've been talking about a lot on this podcast, is now over for a while, as is so many people's lives who rely on the arts and entertainment. But of course, what is currently going on in the world has much broader ramifications for public safety and public health, and all these organisations are doing their best to help and control, the spread of this pandemic, obviously, at the moment. So they have to make some hard choices, but those things, of course, have real-life consequences. So if you're out there getting food, be nice to the people at the checkouts. Try to look out for each other and protect each other. And this is one of those times where you try to think of the greater good and the people who are doing it much worse than you're doing it. But I will say this. It was a terrible time for me to give up my regular job to just do stand-up. So if you like this podcast and you have been looking for an excuse to subscribe to this podcast, this would be obviously the perfect time to do it. So if you could go to patreon.com/willosophy and sign up, for as little as a dollar a month, it all helps at the moment. But particularly if you think it's worth $5 or $10 or $50, there's been over 100 episodes of this. And if you think each of them is worth a dollar, then maybe you might sign up at the $10 level for monthly withdrawals and help us out at this moment when we need your help. We do have a bunch of episodes banked, so we're not going to miss out necessarily, in this period of time where we're not really getting in the same room with people and putting these podcasts on. If it continues for ages, then I guess we're going to have to look at, different ways to put out the podcast. But in the short term, it will still be coming out weekly. And if you have some extra time to be consuming some media and some content, maybe go to some of the podcasts that you might not have listened to if you only go to the big names. I would recommend checking out Nellie Thomas, because Nellie Thomas is the person who I loved her podcast, and we actually spoke about a whole bunch of things that are very relevant to what the world's going through right now. And she was the person who recommended today's guest, Namila Benson. Wow, what an absolutely extraordinary woman she is. What a brilliant chat this was. It was so much fun, and hopefully the sort of conversation that you really need to hear right now from just a fierce and fabulous guest on this show. So it was a great pleasure to meet her in person and then to just get on so well with her and have this, really fantastic conversation. So if you enjoy it, please firstly hit her up and let you know that you enjoyed it. And yes, patreon.com/willosophy. Look, I have shows that are still on later in the year at this point. So if you want to buy tickets to those, that will just reassure me. But I can understand people's hesitancy to commit to anything in public. And of course, if the shows do not go ahead at any stage, they all get refunded. Melbourne shows, what do we do about those? Well, I guess, depending on how long this all lasts, maybe there'll be an opportunity to take those shows to Melbourne later in the year, or maybe it's going to be a 2021 thing at this stage. It was a pretty shocking time for us all to realise that, this would have been my 25th Melbourne International Comedy Festival in a row. But of course, it's not happening because there is no comedy festival. It's a pretty huge thing for those of us who work in this industry. But I also genuinely have my greatest sympathies for people who work in all industries across society that have been, very much impacted by this. And I know for so many people, this is going to be an incredibly hard time, an incredibly difficult time. We don't live in a world these days where people really have savings to get through 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 months of, not paying their rent or not paying their mortgage or not being able to afford groceries or, get what they need. So just be kind to each other. Let's work together and not against each other through this time. And I hope you enjoy today's episode. Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and this is how the podcast starts. It starts by me asking my guests who they are. So who are you?
I'm Namila Benson. Hello there. and I am a presenter on The Art Show over at the National Broadcaster. I'm a mum, I'm a very proud sister, I'm a Tolai Melanesian woman from PNG, and one of my aunties up in Hayfield actually said to say hey to you, Will.
Is that right? It's rare that somebody from Hayfield actually says hey to me, I've got to be honest with you.
She spoke very highly of you.
Normally they say good riddance.
Oh, it's lovely.
Don't come back.
No, it wasn't that at all. But she said to say hello. My Auntie Lavinia.
Well, hello, Auntie Lavinia, if you're having a listen. It's nice to have you involved. Now, okay, where do we start with all that? Let's start with presenter, because you did say that first. So even the word presenter is interesting to me. So why presenter? Why not radio host or broadcaster? Or presenter is a specific choice of word. Is it your word, or is that just a word that, you know, has been assigned to what you do?
It's kind of been assigned to what I do. I usually call myself a broadcaster, but presenter's an interesting one. I think the dynamic there, because I feel like I've been a producer, a radio producer for so long, and the producer kind of does all the hard yards, and then the presenter hands in the homework, don't they, under their name.
Well, not with this podcast. I'm doing a lot of hard yards as well. Don't let Mike get a big head over there.
But yeah, presenter is kind of, that seems to be the key term that gets thrown around quite a fair bit. But yeah, broadcaster is probably what I'm most comfortable with. But yeah, radio has just, I mean, the magic of radio, you know, and being a Islander woman from, you know, an Indigenous Papua New Guinean background, and just seeing the power of radio from such a young age in terms of going on holidays back to PNG. I don't know if you ever used to listen to Casey Kasem's American Top 40.
One of the most famous radio shows of all time, of course.
Right, and amazing. And I could listen to that in suburban Melbourne, and when we'd go on holidays over to the islands, I'd be able to connect to exactly the same show without missing a beat, and just feeling like my life was able to continue on over there. But seeing my grandparents, who we call our bubbles, seeing my bubbles sitting on woven mats in the village and seeing how heavily they were tapped into global politics, speaking very polished English, and it was radio that taught them that, you know, and that sense of intimacy and interaction, all of that kind of stuff just opened up a whole world for me. And I feel like radio and the arts is the place where I've been able to find and connect to my story and also find my people.
So, well, that's a wonderful answer about the connection to broadcasting and radio, and specifically when it comes to broadcasting. So what age would you have been when you start to discover the magic of radio? Because I have different but similar memories about radio, because growing up in the country, you feel quite disconnected from, you know, city culture, and then, you know, the global culture. You know,
yes.
I say in this day and age, because growing up in East Gippsland, it was pre-Triple J days as well. So if you were a kid who liked The Cure, the only way that you were ever going to, maybe Rage would do a special where they played some Cure videos, but otherwise it was a trip to the city and traipsing around record stores to go and find that, you know, that cassette tape of The Cure, and certainly not having a whole bunch of other kids in your community that you could identify with and talk to about it. And radio was the first time that you were like, oh, I'm connected to other people. You know, they might be the kid in their town who's a bit different as well, but in each town there's a kid who's a bit different, and I can have a connection to those kids through this music and through these stories that are being told on the radio.
It's so true that you say that. And I was that little kid who would listen. And so, you know, I was probably about 4 or 5 years old, but listening to 3XY, and later on it was Eon FM and stations like that. But I would have the double cassette radio radios that, you know, I was gifted over the years. And, yeah, recording snippets of TV shows, not TV shows, sorry, recording snippets of radio shows. And you would stop when the presenter would come on to back announce songs. And, you know, I did all of that from a very, very young age. But yeah, my awareness of radio, even though I wasn't able to verbalise it as a very young child, just kind of asking questions about how my life could continue no matter what context I was in, whether it was suburban Melbourne or this really remote village on this tiny island, there was something so powerful about that for me. And, you know, like with media, being Papua New New Guinean and living in Australia, I would kind of see news reports, I still do, about my homeland and think, that's not what home is like. That's not what my country is like. That's not what my people are like. And just being able to step into community radio and seeing these really amazing, proud First Nations, so Black women on radio, and hearing them unapologetically stepping up to the mic, sharing their stories, telling their own narratives and taking ownership of who and what they are and dictating those terms was incredibly powerful for me.
Do you remember the first person that, you know, I mean, when we go from taping Casey Kasem's Top 40 off the radio and making your own mixtapes, which I imagine was, you know, the story, which is what I was doing as well, and getting annoyed when Casey talked over the intro too much because, you know, I was trying to cut that off of a mixtape there, Casey. So, but which of these, you know, sort of powerful speakers, these voices, do you remember who you first heard and who it was that inspired you?
Well, it was actually who I first saw. And I remember when I started at this great radio station in Melbourne called 3CR, that was where I got my first big break 26 years ago. And I kind of started off on reception, and after 2 weeks, as is the way with community radio, I was randomly thrown on air because the presenter couldn't turn up. I had no radio experience whatsoever.
How much reception experience did you have when you were doing the job?
Not much. Yeah, either. Okay, so that's fine. I was pretty crap at both of them.
It's, as good as this as I am as answering the phones, guys, so we might as well give me a crack at this.
And it worked. But, you know, they just threw me on air, threw some CDs at me, and I was on after two amazing women. So Auntie Destiny Deacon, who's an incredible artist, and the late Auntie Lisa Belair. And these two women, the absolute care that they took with their community stories, how kind and generous they were with giving me advice and making sure I was protected. I mean, I was probably about 18 or 19 at the time. And that was profound because I'd never seen women who looked like them in media at all, whether it was mainstream or any form of media. And the way that that shaped what my abilities would be and how I actually had the right to be behind the mic was profound. It changed me in so many ways, and I really hope that I get a chance to say that to Auntie Destiny one day, because it was amazing. And she used to do this really funny segment where she would do horoscopes each week, but she would do it in an Irish accent,
right?
And really bad horoscopes, like just terrible horoscopes. And yeah, just that you could have fun with that kind of stuff as well. It didn't always have to be heavily political and feeling like I had to be answerable all the time on, you know, on behalf of my community, which is, I think, when you're not part of a majority dynamic, in particular whiteness, that's a huge responsibility that you carry that you can't just be, but that every time you step up in whatever way to speak to a broader public, that you kind of have to be answerable and mindful of how you take up space, because you don't want it to have deeper and further impacts.
It's an incredible responsibility, really. And, you know, like you said, one that is so unfair. I mean, I'm a white straight man, so obviously I know what it's like to struggle, be the minority, not get opportunities because of the colour of my skin and my sexuality. It's been tough. It's been a real tough run. But no, but I mean, we talk about it a lot on this podcast, which is the idea of, you know, that you've got to be able to see it to be it, and, you know, how important that is. And the fact that I was a kid on a dairy farm in country Victoria from, you know, farmer parents and dairy farmer, you know, grandparents. But when I looked at the television and heard the radio and saw pictures in the paper of people doing stuff, they still looked like me, you know, like what I would look like when I grew up. So I grew up in a world where, despite the fact that I shouldn't have thought that anything was possible other than living on that road and milking cows, I thought that everything was possible because when I saw people doing things, most of those people looked like me. Mm. And so how powerful an advantage that is in life, that you've just never had to think, could I do this? Is this for me? Versus somebody who every time they get an opportunity goes, firstly, I don't see people like me doing this. And then if I do get an opportunity to do this, I now have to be a representative for all the people who, you know, look like me or have my story, or I'm representing a whole bunch of people that don't even look like me.
Yeah.
I'm the one, you know, token spot on behalf of every, you know, person that is not being seen.
Will, you've so hit the nail on the head. And even now I feel like, yes, there's an awareness. There is a shift that's kind of happening, but we've trapped ourselves as well. Like, this word diversity to me is just so incredibly problematic because, I mean, I've been doing what I've been doing as a broadcaster and a producer for so long, but it's still seen as such a win for my community. And it's just like, that is heavy because I just want to be able to do what I do without having to kind of explain stuff all the time. But, you know, even when I go into certain spaces that I just don't really bother to step into now, I'm still introduced as the Pacific Islander broadcaster. But, you know, I'm so much more than that. And just the way others decide how they will frame you in accordance with what is convenient for their box ticking is a huge thing that I'm still struggling to get my head around.
So that's interesting to me. Can you talk to me a little bit more about even the language and the labelling? You said diversity, you know, the label, because we are in this world and I can see it. And I think partly it's a responsibility for people to externally start to see it. You know, to reframe that idea of going, if I'm going to speak to you, please don't make it all about, you know, some experience that is seen through. Well, as much as you're comfortable and you bring up, but, you know, it's not, it's got to be about seeing somebody as being more whole. And that's why I love that thing you said about the Irish accents and the horoscopes.
Yes.
Because to me, that's a classic example of going, no, this is just funny because it's funny.
Yeah.
It isn't about, you know, culture or history, or it might be still in a sneaky way, but it's it's funny and fun. And you should have permission to just be judged for what you've done and the stories you tell rather than this other thing that gets layered on top all the time.
It's so true because it's this whole thing of how you also have to carry a lot of heaviness with spaces that you step into. Like, I will often be asked to moderate conversations around race and around culture and around womanhood and, you know, different elements of identity culture. And of course, that's something I'm incredibly passionate about. But also too, you know, you want to talk about things like sex and dating and just stuff where you can just show a much more lighthearted side to yourself, because you're so often pigeonholed as being someone who can be quite staunch. And, you know, there is still the mentality around when you speak passionately and you're a woman of colour, you're labelled as the angry black woman. Like, these, it's so problematic with kind of needing to pay bills and do certain gigs. And that's another thing as well.
I'm happy to be an angry black woman a few days a week for some cash. I've still got some bills to pay. If you guys need it, I can ABW Thursdays and Tuesdays, but that's all I can do at the moment.
But they don't always pay as well.
So oh, they're the freebies.
Yes.
Oh, I have to be ABW for free? No, thank you. I'll be providing my ABN for this ABW work.
And that's just it. It's like people think that you'll be happy to do it on behalf of your community,
right,
or, you know, not.
And
really.
I imagine you do a lot of it because you do probably feel a good responsibility to represent people. And if you are given an opportunity, that's probably the both sides of the coin, is that you're like, I would love to not always have to do this, but if there is an opportunity here for a voice to be, to be, you know, expressed, then, and you think I can do it, then also I do feel a responsibility to do it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, thankfully now there's more folks in the pool. Mm. So because I've sort of been around doing it for quite a while now, I can happily hand on to younger sisters who are incredibly smart and just remarkably confident. I mean, I look at my parents' generation, and as migrants, you know, they minded their P's and Q's. They kept very quiet, and they were kind of like the grateful generation who were thankful to have an opportunity to bring their families abroad, for their kids to be educated within a Western system, all of that kind of stuff. I feel like my generation is a little more outspoken, but we're still the apologist generation in a lot of ways, because someone will say something problematic and I still feel the need to say, listen, I'm sorry, but I just, you know, I do a little bit of that. I'll always preface what I'm going to say away with an apology just to make it a bit gentler. But let me tell you, like some of these younger sisters...
No apologies.
Yo, like, it's frightening and joyous yeah. at the same time about how they're not looking for permission
no.
and they're not fussed whether or not you want them to be there. They will be there. And, you know, they are completely unapologetic about who and what they are. They set their terms and they don't bother to play the niceties, you know. And I think that with a lot of the younger generation beyond just the young black sisters, it's really, like, do you notice that, this younger generation?
I mean, I think in general, like, there is a, you know, a confidence about them. I noticed that the kids' climate rally and around the climate issue, you know, how kids are being a lot less apologetic about being kids and a lot more demanding about the fact that, you know, the world needs to be better and we need to do something about it. But certainly when it comes to younger voices, you certainly see it, you know, in the media, you'll see, and it's also what the old media reacts so violently towards is these unapologetic newer voices of the next generation who aren't coming in with a bit of a, I'm sorry, but this is, you know, like, you know, approach. They're coming in with a, no, I'm going to, you know, speak my truth and I'm not going to apologize for it. And this is the same people who get demonized and run out of town and, you know, end up on the front page of, you know, News Limited for, you know, 2 weeks in a row because they, you know, dare be a, you know, a person who doesn't look like what we imagine, you know, Paul Hogan's Australia.
Yes.
And, you know, they dare have an opinion or a voice or say that something might be a problem. We still, I think Australia still finds that a very tough thing to hear.
Oh, absolutely, because Australia doesn't like having a mirror held up to it. And I think a big thing that I have kind of identified with younger people, they have language. They have language to be able to name and sometimes shame what is going on. And that, to me, has given them access to a lot of power in that way that, you know, like, yo, some of the stuff that goes on online, you know, you're just, I am absolutely thrown by the fact that they are able to, in a, you know, like they might not necessarily come from an academic background, but being able to call someone to task and being able to list why that person is problematic and to be able to frame their arguments within a broader structure and all of that kind of stuff is just amazing for me to watch. I learn a lot. It sounds very cliched, but I learn a lot from a lot of the young people that I work alongside because... Yeah, just the way that they are doing life and kicking goals, I'm like, I really need to take some notes.
Oh, well, that's a wonderful response to have. You know, firstly, you know, because I think that a lot of the time people who, you know, as you get older and these younger voices come through, sometimes people can find it very confronting and very challenging that, you know, and... You know, there's a lot of talk around issues, you know, in society in general where there's, you know, the two approaches and the cliched way of looking at it would be, and this is a lack of understanding of these two men, but it's the cliched one that they use in history, which is it the Malcolm X journey versus the Martin Luther King, you know, and it's painted very much as Malcolm X being quite militant and Martin Luther King being less so. If you know much about that, that's actually... a misrepresentation of, you know, both of those two men in a lot of ways. But it became that what people look at of like these are which approach works better. Yeah. I tend to find a combination of both approaches.
Absolutely.
You know, I Clem Ford's a good example. You know, not everybody's going to approach feminism in the way that Clem approaches feminism. Mm. But I think the conversation around it is a much better conversation for somebody, you know, having the bravery and the forthright. Yeah, bravery is probably even the wrong word, but you understand courage. What I mean. The courage.
Yeah. And fortitude.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
To do it and know what's going to happen. That doesn't mean that every feminist has to sing from the same playbook, but I think it's important that these debates have, you know, people who are more on the more militant end versus people who are on the more opening everybody up and, you know, conciliatory end. To me, it feels like a combination of all those things is probably what we need in debates. You know, you need the socialist who says burn down the entire system and you need someone going, well, maybe we could just change capitalism a bit first before we burn down everything. And it's important that all those voices are there.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. I think this week in particular has been a case in point with a lot of the discussions that have been going on, particularly around masculinity and, you know, the shifts that are happening within that. And that was something that I looked at on this week's show for the art show is just how do you frame and like what does healthy masculinity look like in contemporary Australia? And I did it through the lens of a couple of visual artists. But yeah, looking at the debates on social media and Twitter, I really try to avoid because I just so think it's where decency goes to wither up and die. But it's just, but then on the other hand, you know, like there's just been some powerful things that I've read. But yeah, I mean, you know, like seeing so many of these young ones just stepping up and taking on, you know, people who represent the very problematic end of particular structures like capitalism and white supremacy and many other structures that we can talk about as well. But yeah, that's been powerful for me to just sit back and read and watch and listen to what they're saying.
So when you look at the, you know, the next generation of, you know, people in general, I'm really speaking about now, but, you know, take this in whatever way you want to, but what do you think? Are they hopeful? Are they angry? Are they scared about the state of the world? What's your sense of what this next generation is really feeling?
It's a hard thing, isn't it? Because I think history has always proven, what's that saying, the reactionaries of today, no, the revolutionaries of today will be the reactionaries of tomorrow. So you never quite know, you know, like how things will go. But I'm a mum and I have got a 6 and a 7-year-old and their capacity to take on and discuss and understand things that really grown adults just have no idea about. So a case in point is that recently we went to Papua New Guinea for the first time as a
first
family.
Time.
Yes. As a with the family. I've gone back many, many times, but I hadn't taken, because I really wanted the boys to be of an age to really remember that, that first time as well. So my partner and I went over. My partner is Australian. He had never been to PNG, hadn't met, you know, like my extended, very, very extended PNG family. But, you know, with mum just talking, and mum has had lived in Australia for quite a few years, but she's a traditional village woman at heart, you know, and there's a lot that you're not exposed to in the islands whatsoever that we take for granted here in a Western society.
Like?
Around identities. And, you know, we were talking about some very, very dear friends of ours who are non-binary. And for mum, trying to explain to her in a mix of language, but also in English, that no, mum, you don't refer to them as he, she, it's they, them. And mum and I were having a hearty debate about this, and she was like, but you're talking about plurals. It doesn't make sense if it's a singular person. And there was a point in the conversation where she goes, I don't understand. And my 6-year-old said, Bubu, you know, grandma, Bubu, it's not for you to understand. You have to just respect. And that was, and mum got it from that point. Like, you know, as heartily as we were talking and debating about why, you know, she needed to address friends in a particular way, like it took my 6-year-old to step in, and mum was laughing and she goes, okay, I get it. Because respect in Islander culture, that is something she can roll with, you know, like he knew to step in and to frame this conversation in a way that his elderly bubble would understand.
I mean, it's genuinely a bit of one of the best bits of philosophy that I've had on this podcast. Should have got him on.
I mean, I can check in with his manager. His manager's 7, but he'll come in too.
I mean, but it is genuinely what a brilliant, you know,
it's
insight,
so
because we don't need to understand everything either. Like, I think often we get bogged down in trying to, like, I mean, even, it's again, like, talk about the climate. I know it's a very different thing, but I try to at least talk about some things where, you know, I might not have the personal, you know, experience of that, but at least, you know, when it comes to the planet, I can look at it this. The amount of people who try to argue over bits and pieces of the science and the research, where, like, it shouldn't actually be a debate over whether you think you've interpreted it better. You're not a climate scientist. Like, you know, so all it should be is you don't need to understand it. You just need to respect the people whose job it is to understand it. Like, there's a broader point to what he's saying there, which is, you don't need to. Just respect them as people. They want to be called this. In the same way as we respect you by calling you by, a grandma, grandpa, nana, yes. Pa. We do this all the time.
Yeah.
It's not an unusual, there's 18 different names for grandparents. As in, it's like we decided to call this one nana and this one, grandma, and everyone goes, fine.
Absolutely. There's no question.
There's no I don't understand why she's grandma and she's nana. Explain it to me again. No, I'm calling them both grandma. They are both grandmas. No, it doesn't.
But you've spoken to so many people. Why do you think it is so difficult for some to be just so unwilling to understand there are other ways of being? What do you think is in that?
Well, I mean, I think that I think it's hard enough for people I haven't thought about this so much, but I think it's hard enough for people to understand what their own life is about. Mm. And often that comes down to, that's where traditions come from and, stories and these sort of things. They're guides for us on how we should be living our life, right? Am I living in the way of, my parents, my grandparents, what I have been taught culturally? So then that in itself is hard enough.
Yeah.
To then realize there's all these other different theories and versions and people do all these things differently. I think it can be an incredibly confronting thing for people, probably.
Absolutely. And this is the thing, you were asking about the next generation. I look at my kids and I look at their friends and, things are in good hands, just purely for the sole reason that they are willing to actually roll around ideas in their head and think about other ways of being and to ask questions about it. They don't shut things down. Sometimes it can be quite a difficult or fraught conversation with some aspects of things they're trying to understand as little kids, but the possibility is there that, that's not of my world, and let me ask mummy and daddy more questions about this. And they do it. They'll sit and engage. They know how to engage in a way that even I have been guilty of, just kind of shutting down particular ways of being, because I can't roll with what you're saying. That is just so wrong on so many levels, and I don't even want to begin to understand how you've come to this point to think of a situation in this way. I do that. And maybe it's survival for a lot of people as well. But I am very good at shutting out noise. And I actually did a show on another community broadcaster on Triple R called White Noise. And it was about identity, race and culture. And it was about shutting out, a lot of that white noise. Because when you have to fight so hard to just kind of make someone have an awareness of your humanity, that's exhausting. And that's my boundary. I don't even enter into those conversations where I feel I have to change your mind. I won't do that anymore.
Okay, so that's interesting to me, because it's how do you change someone's mind anyway is such a huge question, because I think it's one that we're failing at the moment, in that. Yeah, there's a group of people who think that just having better facts will change people's minds, but it doesn't. Or making up facts. Well, that's so this is now the world that we live in, where there's one side that's just like, well, if I just tell you the facts, that will convince everybody. Hmm. It doesn't, because there's a whole set of other facts
to counter that
people can now have, and narratives that they can, In the week that we're recording this, and I won't go into the story too much, but, there was a kid who was bullied, online. He gets some publicity and some people try to look after him, and then the internet turns into one of the worst places on earth, where people start to discredit the story. They start to spread malicious and horrible rumours and innuendo, and when one is knocked on the head and disproved, then another one comes along. And it's a classic example of, it doesn't matter how many times you can actually say, no, here's the truth. Here are some people who know this child, who know the family, who can verify this is what's going on. There are already 20 different, racist, sexist, ableist, memes floating around, or stories being passed. So when we're in this world now where you can't just convince somebody with, How do we move forward? Like, it's a troubling time in a lot of ways for the nature of debate, because it can't be healthy for us to go back to us all being in our bubbles and not talking to each other.
Mm.
So how do we engage and how do we move forward? I don't expect you to have the whole answer, but what are your thoughts about that?
I mean, I do a lot of moderating with public events, so that is a way I can keep a distance from a broad audience, but also engage with them, with people who are highly specialised in questions that I might have, which might be a bit uncomfortable to ask in a one-on-one situation. I think radio is amazing for that as well, in order to be able to reach huge audiences, because there's something about the intimacy of radio. And I know so many times, countless times, and everyone's got this experience where you just need to stay in the car, even though you are running so hella late for an appointment, because you need to listen to this conversation where you're actually getting something out of it. You might not be able to relate, you might not even agree, but there's something about people being able to come to the table with their views and their experiences and their perspectives and being able to engage in a respectful way. So I don't know what, like, changing people's minds. And I remember the turning point for me was just seeing that famous saying, and I'm totally paraphrasing here, by Toni Morrison, who said, you know, like, a huge element of racism is distraction. Like, you know, you come to the table, someone says something about you, you prove them wrong, and then they'll come back with another argument, and you've got to spend another 20 years proving them wrong on that. And it's just this ongoing cycle. And for me, at this point in my life, it's my children and their friends that I really roll with at the moment, because I know that I'm able to help shape them and plant ideas for them to think about and to talk about with each other. But in terms of adults, like, I don't know how hard it's hard to rewire your brain.
Yeah, maybe we just need to write off this generation and start again. So that's a terrible plan. And, of course, we shouldn't follow that through. I know a lot of terrible people in history have had similar sort of thoughts.
You're going to get hate mail, yeah. Will.
Okay, I've got to ask you if you have a philosophy, because otherwise I'll forget to do it and we'll just gas bag for the entire thing and I won't have asked you whether you have a philosophy. So do you have a life philosophy, a work philosophy, a love philosophy, a parenting philosophy? Is there some guiding principle by which you live your life?
Wow, that is such a huge one. Mm. Do I have a philosophy? I mean, because it changes constantly, doesn't it, really? But
if I ask you now, what is it? At the moment?
Yeah. It's hard to sort of answer as well without sounding cliched.
Well, cliche is okay for this portion of the interview. It is tough to know. I'm asking you to, like, really sum up a much bigger conversation with a line or two so that we can, you know, put it on the tile and promote the podcast and also, you know, so that we can have a broader conversation. But
yeah.
I also just like the idea of having to think about it for a bit and say, what is it that is, you know, what do I think my guiding principle is? What is my philosophy?
I mean, at this stage of my life, it honestly is do you boo? Because I'm very privileged that I'm able to step into the role that I'm stepping into over at the National Broadcaster, but I'm also stepping into a structure and an institution that I can find problematic and that I do struggle with at times, but I have my core ethos in terms of it's no secret what kind of drives my work and the narratives that I choose to focus on and who I want to reach. It's that whole thing, you know, like, I think as we're absorbing media, you know, just constantly looking at who's asking, who's telling the stories, who are they telling the stories about and who are they telling the stories to. And for the art show, my big thing is that art can be very high end. And at the National Broadcaster, it has been that for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. But for me, I want to be able to reach people like my aunties who are listening in Townsville and Cairns and Brizzy and Darwin, and they listen in each week, and to break down institutions that have not been overly welcoming to them and their stories, and have actually reframed and revisioned history and historical stories, you know, for my people, and to kind of tackle that head on and to start shifting narratives around that. Because, you know, there was something I was reading during the week that someone had posted on Twitter where they said, you know, if British museums were to repatriate and return their collections, basically all their galleries would be bedpans and images of Stonehenge, you know? Like, that would be it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I love that.
Ironically, a lot of people don't know this, but the bedpan and Stonehenge were both invented for people to piss behind. It's true. That's why, like, there's a mystery of Stonehenge, but it was really, they just, it's a giant public toilet. May or may not be true. controversial new theory that I'm working on.
I love
on.
That you're adding to my art history there.
may not be fake news. Why art as an important way in? Why is art a powerful way to tell these stories?
Like, I'm not an artist myself, but how it is such a gift that someone is able to create discomfort, that they're able to disrupt, that they're able to kind of plant a seed of other ways of being. Like, that to me is such a gift that you can do that, and you can do it from a single object. You can do that from a single image. You can, like radio, just have the power to tell your own stories and your own experience, and to do it in a really intimate way where people have to, like, you're forced to engage with particular works, and you have to put that, I mean, the way you connect is through your own lens, and the way that art has been able to do that for me in so many ways, and I've been able to find my experiences. I mean, I grew up in Camberwell and Hawthorne, and it's a very lovely area, but it's polite. It's a very well-to-do area here in Melbourne. I didn't hear any black stories. I didn't see other black faces. I lived there for 20 years, and going into libraries and being able to get books where I would see stories of my people and images of my people, and just that the arts just opened up a whole new world for me. But then going to actual museums and galleries, I didn't feel welcome in those spaces, and, you know, having to deal with the gaze on so many levels, because you have to do it in day-to-day life. Like, you know, I've got quite a big red afro, and the fact that people just want to touch you and they look at, like,
so hang on, I've heard of this before, but so is this a real I mean, obviously it's a real thing because I've heard people say that it's a real thing, but I've actually never had someone I could have a conversation with about this. Is the touching you thing an absolutely real thing?
It is so real. I don't even know where to begin with it. The layers to, and, you know, I don't know, like, white people in Australia need to hang out with more black people because it's just, they see you and you're like an inanimate object.
Like, are you part of this exhibition?
Yes.
Are you interactive? Kids.
Look.
It's amazing.
But it's, yeah, like, people just, you know, and just asking things like, oh, do you wash your hair? And just wanting to touch your skin, but being so surprised. I don't know if they think that black skin is reptilian or something, but just being amazed that actually it's soft, and just things like that is really weird. And it's not children, can I tell you, Will?
No.
It's adults. But, yeah, people, but there's a, and all sisters know it, there's kind of a crazy look that some people get because you can see that they've clocked you in the distance. And then they'll start, like, making moves to somehow get closer, and you're just like, don't make eye contact, like, look anywhere but at that person, because, you know, as soon as you make eye contact, then that's the invitation for them to just step right into your space bubble, and ask very invasive questions. You know, it's a lot.
So you're in these spaces then where people also are like, you're an other here, you know,
yes.
We're making it clear to you that you are another here. You know, the complete opposite of what art should be. In fact, I had a wonderful comment from someone actually in Adelaide years ago, which I think was actually very, you know, it was harsh, but it was a fair and valid comment, and not one that I certainly, you know, had. Oh, well, I'll just tell you, and then you can, you know, rather than me sort of dancing around explaining something before I've actually just said it.
Okay, yeah. What's he avoiding?
Well, no, because I was doing a whole bit about, it was a whole piece that I had about Australia Day and changing the date and, like, you know, obviously, you know, a really, you know, I mean, you know, in my classic, you know, privileged white man way, you know, pat myself on the back for all the good points I'm making. And the guy came up to me afterwards and he goes, I love that bit, but I look around your audience and I don't see a lot of, you know, black faces, even though you're still doing this bit, you know what I mean? As in, like, you know, and I said, well, that's true. I certainly don't have control over who comes to my show, but I think it's a valid point, you know, and it's certainly not, I think, that my work is, you know, saying that you're another in this space, but maybe just the nature of going to these shows, going to a theatre in the city, going to this festival, it's been a history of telling people that they, you know, are not welcome in these spaces, you know,
like,
and, or that, you know, you don't belong there, or this stuff is not for you.
Yes. And, you know, it's a funny thing because I was born and bred in Melbourne, but I'm very, very connected to my PNG culture. And I actually say that I'm a Tolai woman first and foremost.
And what is that the name of?
So that's the name of the region and the people that I come from in Papua New Guinea. It's an island called Rabaul, which is in the East New Britain province. So it's not on the mainland, but we're a very, very proud culture. And you know, like, Papua New Guinea is such an interesting nation because there's over 800 distinct languages and over 1,000 different dialects. And, you know, I think for the outsider, they just see a PNG person and just think they're from PNG. But, you know, like, there's the specifics that are tied in with a person's land. And, I mean, very similar, I guess, to First Nations culture as well. But people get upset that I don't necessarily identify myself as Australian, but they don't understand that I've never been made to feel welcome as an Australian, and I'm constantly having to kind of justify and explain things and, you know, have to be answerable on behalf of my community when things happen. And PNG, of course, it's not a perfect country, neither is Australia, but it's just... Is that it? All right, it's been great talking. But, yeah, people really get quite offended about that. And it's such an interesting thing when someone else is like, well, she sounds Australian. Yeah. She's lived here for heaps of years. Why doesn't she identify herself as Australian? But then if an islander is going to do something, you know, problematic, then all of a sudden I have to explain that as well. But, yeah, I definitely state that I'm Papua New Guinean through and through, and I very proudly state that because also too I think it's important for nieces and nephews and younger ones growing up to not have to, because so many kids feel they have to hide, you know, like their cultural backgrounds. And I just don't want that for especially my kids as well. Like, they very proudly claim that they're Papua New Guinean, and I love that more than words. And they will, you know, like, just they're so tapped in with our cultural ways.
And what, so tell me a little bit about the culture.
So Tolai culture is a matrilineal culture. Women are incredibly empowered. So men marry us for land, and, you know, when relationships fall apart, we keep the kids. So I actually took a lot of feminism subjects when I was at university because I couldn't quite understand, I just couldn't quite get my head around why this concept was necessarily needed, because I guess in my life, race has been the one thing that has hugely impacted me even before my gender, you know, and I never questioned being able to do something or not being able to do something based on my gender. And so university was kind of where I learned a lot about feminism. And these days, I guess intersectionality is kind of more what I'm about when it comes to feminism. But yeah, that
explain what you mean by that.
So intersectionality is basically looking at the multiple intersections that impact the ways that you experience the world. So for folks of colour, it's not just about their gender. It's also about race. It's about disability. Mm. It's about religion. So it's all those, lots and lots of intersections. It's something that has, I never had the language before to be able to identify, why it was that I couldn't quite roll with some white feminists and how I felt very on the outer when they would be shouting so loudly about certain aspects of how we were being impacted as women and just also not having the confidence, to be honest, to speak up about that kind of stuff. I've totally lost my train of mind.
The story of the culture that you know, influence, the way that you were looking at feminism, but also obviously the reason I wanted to stop down on intersectionality is that, it's a term that I understand because, I spend a lot of time on the internet. Yes. But I don't expect that everybody else who listens to the podcast the time to... And, I think we can be very guilty sometimes in our society of, the classic thing of judging somebody for not knowing something that you only learnt 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And you become an immediate expert and then everybody else who didn't know how to use this or that. And
it's
true. And we're people who work in the public space and have time to hear ideas, talk to other people about ideas, process them ourselves, understand what the language is around it, what it might mean. But just having that explanation of, what that actually means is that, feminism is going to mean something very different to a white woman. It doesn't mean that her feminism is irrelevant or, because it is, it's an issue, but they're going to be different issues to a person of color who's, experienced that. Some of them will be the same, some of them will be different.
Yes.
And, somebody, like you said, ableism, all these sort of things.
Yeah.
There is a broad church of things that can contribute to them, and feminism doesn't need to be the same thing or have the same issues or the same struggles for each one. But the reason we got into that was that you were telling me about the culture and how it was, you'd grown up and seen something very different again.
Yeah, and I think the strong sense of community in Tolai culture is something that very, very much informs my life here in Australia as well. But Tolai culture, to be able to sum it up, it is like the love and the warmth and the hospitality and the sense of community and the way people show up constantly for each other is a huge thing, because we live in times where there's a lot of fatigue and a lot of exhaustion with knowing where to kind of, what to prioritise, what cause, what community, all of that, who to prioritise in terms of what's important for you and making sure that you show up. But the way family is so centred within that, for me, has been a huge thing because, parenthood has really shifted things in a lot of ways for me. I don't always enjoy it. And you're not allowed to talk about motherhood as being boring and not always pleasant and that it's hard. And
what is hard about it? What I mean, as in, because I've never heard anybody.
it's true.
But what do you struggle with the most with it?
I think for me, not having my community around me, not having my mum here, my extended aunties, etc., is a big thing, because parenting really does take a village. There's no doubt about that. But I have become so close to my Tolai culture, which has given me an incredibly strong sense of who I am. So I feel like just the confidence it's equipped me with to be able to face the world, to speak my truth and to just do me has been profound, because I know that I have a place I can go to, which is going to be a haven for me where there's not going to be judgment. I will be accepted, but also too, I will be taken to task and questioned about stuff where I have to be answerable as well. And I think that is a really important thing with communities, is that it's not just all the fluffy stuff, but you have to be forced every now and then to reevaluate while you're being trash sometimes, because that happens,
That's a really interesting insight, because you're right. We think of community so much about the idea of, the bushfires happen and the community comes together and they all work together and they help each other. But it's not just being there in a moment of crisis, is it, community? Community can often be, to be there to, you know, get you to pull your head in or to tell you that you're about to go off the rails or to, you know, like...
And call out culture is big, but, you know, I think that's more and more people are sort of moving towards call-in culture, which is this whole thing of taking someone aside quietly and going, yo, what you're saying and doing right now is not on. Like, what's going on? Like, you okay, sis? Do we need to talk? Yeah. You know, that kind of stuff, and doing that quietly. And, you know, I think also too within communities, there are people you just don't want to roll with, but because of very surface level parts of your identity, there's automatically supposed to be a connection there. But that's not enough either sometimes, you know. Sometimes people are just trash and you don't have anything in common. And, yeah, I just feel like my Tolai culture and the way it kind of guides my ethics and my morals in terms of how I move in the world and take up space in the world, it's really come to the forefront in the last few years since I've become a mum.
How do you pass that on to your children? What's the – I mean, obviously you know, but what you said, you traveled back, but what lessons are you letting them know? How do you get them to discover your culture? How intrinsic? I mean, if it's intrinsically part of your life, it's obviously being passed on regardless, but do you have a, you know, kind of theory behind how you pass it on?
I think it's mainly in terms of the way that we build communities and with so many Black cultures across the world, you know, you have your blood relatives, but you've also got your community relatives. There's your chosen family, and they're very tapped into that. Like, even if they were to come with me to the studio today, they would know to greet you by calling you uncle, you know, and they know to do that with all their elders. And that at the most basic level is kind of extending to them that they are stepping into and part of a community. But we do it through the foods that we cook. They are deeply embedded in the PNG community here in Melbourne.
Tell me about the food for a start, because I mean, I know this is always the curiosity people have with other cultures, but I also want to know what the food's like. What sort of food are we talking about?
So it's probably very similar to Thai food, actually. So it's lots of coconut milk, lots of seafood. And, you know, like, there's definitely root vegetables. But, yeah, we sort of reframe, usually use banana leaves to wrap food and cook it in the ground when you're back in the homeland. But here we'll use aluminium foil and whack it in the oven. Sometimes if we're lucky, we'll dig up the back. But then you've got to get the right stones for that as well. Right. And it's such a process. But, yeah, it's through dance. It's definitely through music.
Yeah.
My Lord, like, when it comes to music and my...
And is this playing music?
Yes. And singing along to things. And, you know, it's also having access to instrumentation through their uncles who are percussionists. And, you know, like, my partner is an incredible turntablist. So he teaches them how to kind of mix and meld and fuse beats together. And so they're taking like PNG and Islander beats, but then also giving it a bit of the Dilla twist as well. Yeah. So they're really, and especially the 7-year-old, he is an absolute freak of nature with the way that he kind of visualizes music and then is able to create it. And he gets his, he gets these kind of weird staring off into the distance moments when he hears a particular piece of music, and you can see that he's kind of like trying to recontextualize that particular beat so he can mix it with songs from the homeland or with another song that might be in his collection. But yeah, I would say through music, food, and just being embedded in the arts is the way that my boys, you know, like, carry their culture with them every single day. Every day.
Is there a religious aspect to it? Does it come with a belief system?
Yeah, I mean, it does. And look, missionaries, well, obviously, you know, they were very influential with spreading Christianity and the gospel, etc. We're not religious, but my extended family is deeply religious. And I find that kind of hard and sometimes a bit contradictory in a lot of ways, because the land is everything, you know, in PNG culture, no matter where you go. And that's where a lot of spiritual, like, there's just a lot of ways that are kind of done, and it's stuff that, yeah, I mean, I guess culturally I can't really talk about it, but yeah, there's definitely rituals, and my culture as well is incredibly old. And when you go to my mother's land, and that was just such a life-changing moment for me, Will, to see my boys standing on their bubu's land, like that was... Oh, it was everything. And just seeing them, like there's one particular photo where it just captured in that single moment, it's like they'd been there forever as well as never. And that was just, that was everything to me. And seeing them as well with their grandmother on matrilineal land and ancestral land, it's just kids are amazing the way they just adapt. And they were so at home.
Well, that's interesting to me because are you still in the same kind of part of the world that you grew up in, or are you a different part of Melbourne?
Part of Melbourne. Okay, yeah. North side now.
Yeah. They've grown up Melbourne kids, right?
Yes.
Clearly smart kids, you know.
Yeah.
And so I was interested in how what it was like through their eyes. What was that experience to them, you know?
They were just, I mean, look, the one thing that all kids always really love when they go to the islands is you don't put on seatbelts because everyone jumps into the back of the ute. So you're crammed in with family. They loved rolling that.
Yeah, they loved that.
Yeah. So to squeeze them back into the RAV4 when I got home was a struggle. But the way that they just adapted to the mix of languages that were being spoken around them, and even how they knew how to treat our elders, like their multiple grandparents, and just seeing them even with their aunts and uncles, and the way that they were able to play with their cousins who didn't speak a word of English, and my kids speaking very limited Kwanawa, which is our traditional language, you know. It's just, that is kind of amazing to me that you can throw people. And I know that humans are adaptable. I know that. But, for little kids, I think the most important thing is that mama and papa were there as well. So, the fact that they would so happily run off with cousins or go off with uncles or just hang out with their bubus without the parents, that spoke volumes to me.
You talk about the fact that race has been a very defining thing in your life.
Yeah.
Do you think that it will be as defining in their lives? Like, where are we in the world now in regard to that?
It's really, getting back again to just the knowledge that they have and the ideas that they're exposed to. Like, my boys do feel a very deep sense of connection to Rabaul because they understand that they live on stolen land. And people might think that it's a little bit too dense, but they understand ideas of genocide as well, that people were killed, you know, and that this is not their land. And, you know,
I did not hear about this at school, so I'm not sure that this checks out. But I mean, I know it's a dark joke, but it is, I didn't hear about that at school.
Even think I did at university, like a little bit, but, you know, the Captain Cook story was still very told through a particular lens. So last year in August, I wrote a memoir with
Jack Charles,
who's amazing,
one of the all-time greats. One day I would love to have him on this podcast.
You need to. He is incredible. And so,
if anyone actually wants to find my real Facebook page, you can look at the one that has a photo of me and Uncle Jack on it. That's my Facebook header.
He's amazing, isn't he, Uncle? And just the generosity of him being willing, you know, to share so many of his stories. And he's so, Uncle is great, whether he's talking to little kids right through to elders. Like, he's so great with being able to share his story and engage with others and really making sure that people walk away with an understanding of what his history is and how we kind of move forward, you know, within that context. And it really was a privilege working with Uncle. But
what was your approach to working with him on that, because it is an important story to tell and a story of his own that he had to tell.
Yes.
When you're someone who's helping facilitate you know, somebody to be able to tell that story. It's a great responsibility. And
it's huge.
You know, like, so what was the approach? How did you guys work together? How did you, what was your philosophy of putting that together?
Storytelling is Uncle's thing. And, you know, for me as a writer, because I'd never written a book before, I'm a radio girl at heart, always will be. And, you know, for me to sit down and to be able to write about this incredible life thus far that Uncle Jack has lived, we would meet up 2 to 3, sometimes 4 times a week. And it was literally, I would say, okay, Uncle, today I want to talk about X, Y, Z. And 3 or 4 hours later, I would have audio, you know, like you set something down for Uncle and he will be able to wax lyrical. He will take you in many, many directions, but it is extraordinary just being able to learn from him. And, you know, it was devastating because, as you said, Will, like I didn't learn about the truth of this country's history with colonial history and when it was founded through colonial times and just the trauma of genocide and understanding the ongoing intergenerational trauma that happens around that as well. But the generosity of Uncle, just because he wants people to engage, he wants them to learn, but how he has gone through what he has gone through and to not just want to, like, to not be full of rage, it is just extraordinary to me because, you know, I went and spoke to a mental health professional because you're hearing incredibly brutal. And I know for me it was particularly close as well because I've got young kids, and for anyone who understands what Uncle's story is as a stolen person and what he went through, it's just, I don't know how you... You know, for Uncle, he's sort of at this place where he's like, oh, mate, it's just part of my story. You know, like we just got to share the stories and keep them going so that people learn. And
it's often the, and this is one of the things that breaks my heart when I talk about this. And I don't have the words to talk about this, but I talk about it all the time, which is, you know, I feel incredibly grateful for the opportunities that I've been given in this country. But we can never, like, fully go forward and reconcile without just dealing with what was done.
It's like a festering wound on this nation's
and
psyche.
It will continue to be so until we actually do the hard work to deal with it. But the thing that always breaks my heart is that those who have had the harm done to them are so willing to do the work, as in, like, they're willing to tell us their stories. They're willing to share them. The fact that they're not... they're all not just broken and angry and wanting to kill us in our sleep at all times is a miracle. Like, it's us that has the barriers up, you know? Yeah. The people who have had the harm done to them have still, you know, we're not all, you know, I mean, of course, not one person speaks for everybody in this.
But that's right.
But when I see the generosity of a Jack, that's, you know, where you think with everything that you've been put through, the history of your people and then you personally having to experience these things, to still have that generosity of wanting to share this with us and to be, you know, like mates with us and for us to walk forward together.
Yeah.
Like the generosity's there. We need to have the hard conversations and do it. But
the
anyway.
Dismissals, the denials, the disrespect. I mean, the way that Australia as a nation is just so unwilling to acknowledge its own racism is honestly just next level. And, you know, my kids understand, we talk about this kind of stuff. Like, yes, you know, mummy and they will experience racism, but the fact, like, just explain to them so that they understand their place within, you know, this whole context, that this is not your land. Like, what you experience is still as a settler. You still benefit. You still have access to healthcare. Because, you know, I've spoken about this many times, how people in Australia tend to think of racism as being the N-word or wearing, you know, KKK hoods or just, you know, things like that, or burning crosses, et cetera. They don't understand that it's things like not having access to proper housing, not being able to access the workforce, or, you know, having proper access to healthcare and education. Like, they don't think of racism in those terms, but those basic fundamental needs, which people should always have access to, particularly if it's your own frickin' land. You know, the fact that so many have to fight so hard for that is just such a big thing for many white Australians to kind of get their head around. And then it's making up these stories about apparent handouts and all that kind of stuff. It's like, where are you getting your, who are your sources? Like, why and why would you say something so deliberately damaging to deny what is a fact in this country? It's just, it's astounding to me.
But that is, that's where we're at now, where the, you know, the facts themselves are not powerful enough to be, because you can have other facts. You can, you know, have these other stories. You can hear that, you know, whether it be, you know, the refugees are coming here for the, it's always about benefits, basically.
Yes.
normally the best one that they can go to is like, they're here for the benefits, you know. And as someone who spent a little bit of my time on the dole when I started doing stand-up comedy, I can guarantee you the benefits are not that great.
Yeah. But it's just like how people's view Australia's cruelty right. is extraordinary. And especially like in PNG, talking to family over there and lots of questions that we were asking each other, because with Manus Island, you know, like what's happening there and continues to happen. It's just, they were like, why? Because what the local community want is for folks to contribute to the local community right. and to be part of the extended community. And I had no answers or words to kind of explain the cruelty and the harshness of what the government's been doing over there. It's just, you know, I mean, I wanted to hear how locals were kind of responding to the detention centre there, but it's just like, we're so cruel. And we've got all the facts. Like, I legit do not know how much more information white Australia needs to be able to move this conversation forward. And it's just like, is it because of money? Or what? I don't get what it is, why there's no kind of truth in history. It's changing with individual teachers, and I see that now, especially with younger teachers. But, yeah. We have such a long way to go, don't we?
We do, unfortunately. And that, I can't, I mean, you know, it's in, I don't understand why we think a prolonged, like, you know, uncomfortableness with it and denial and all these sort of things is better than us ripping off the Band-Aid either.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I just, like, you know, I feel like, can't we just have this, you know, let's have it properly.
Yeah.
Let's have all this properly and sort out what sort of country we actually want to be. Because at the moment,
that's the question.
We're not having a conversation around what sort of country we want to be. Mm. And no one asked me that. I know they have elections and stuff, but do we really want to be a country that has so much and yet is so cruel to protect what we have? Is that what we consider to be Australian? Like, is, you know, is the denial of the original, you know, the First Nations people, is the, you know, locking up of, you know, mostly brown people, let's be honest, you
yes.
know, on these, you know, prison islands to protect our way of life, you know, is that genuinely a price that we're willing to pay for the quality of life that we have? Because I'm not sure that we've actually had that conversation. And I think that if we do have that conversation on a real level about what sort of country we want to be, aren't we just immediately a better country if we, you know, like you said, in, you know, invite in rather than cast out, you know, that we embrace all our story, even the horrible bits of it, you know, can't we move forward better and stronger and more powerful from that? But we can't just keep denying it, because then we can't move on.
Yeah. But just the fact that so many people, it is not an option to acknowledge. Like, it's just easier, or it's better, or I don't know what people feel that they are going to lose by, yeah, admitting to the truth of this nation's colonial history. And
see, I mean, in some ways, it's the easiest thing of all time, because I mean, I think that it should come with genuine reparations, and
yeah.
you know, there will be complexities to that, but I don't, you know, but the most ironic thing about it is People aren't even really asking for that. No. They're letting us off with such a fucking easy option, which is just to acknowledge the truth in the first place,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
Like, it's not even...
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't come with a price tag. It should. Yeah. Like, I mean, I believe that it should, and perhaps maybe I guess that's where people get... But I remember around Mabo, you know, the fear campaigns around Mabo,
oh,
and it was going to change everything and everyone was going to get turfed off their land and blah, blah, blah. And didn't happen.
Fine. Life continued along.
It was like people marrying dogs after marriage equality. Again, did not heard a lot of fuss about it, but haven't seen a case of a dog wedding. It would be adorable, and I'd love to see it on Instagram, but have not seen one as of yet. What do you think the major problem with where we are in society is right now? I know that's a big thing, but I talked to Nellie Thomas, who is a shared mate of ours.
Yes.
And... you know, she really said we're living wrong. That was her, you know, what she's on at the moment is this idea that the way we actually live as human beings is out of sync with, you know, the planet and each other at the moment. What do you think? Where are we at?
I think she's right. I mean, probably an extension of we're living wrong is we're not living honestly. And I think...
I like that. What do you mean?
I think it is, again, like that, what I was saying earlier, how our inability to kind of face history and look down, right down the barrel at the damage that we've done, to be able to acknowledge it, because it is like a festering wound. It's just not going to get better until we address it. Mm. And it is something that I see so much in my work, just the resistance to be able, because I understand that people don't want to be seen as complicit in you know, just... People don't see themselves as racist, and all they want to do is just, you know, they want to pay off their mortgage and have Barbies with their family, and they don't want to think about this hard stuff. But I'm so with you. I think that if we face up to it and if we address it head on, it's going to be really freaking hard. And it'll be hard for a long time, but we'll be better for it. Like I often think, because legacy, working with Uncle Jack, legacy is a really big thing for him. It's huge. And just always thinking about the groundwork of what he's doing today so that generations down will be able to think back and know that people were there with them and for them and were setting the groundwork and putting things in place. But I just often think, how are future generations going to look back at us at this point in time? And our so-called leaders that are in these positions of power and have the final say over policy around immigration and so much stuff. Like, we're in a crisis mode at the moment. And honestly, when I even look at, and this is a conversation that has been had for years by so many feminists, but yeah, the treatment of women at the moment, I don't know how it is not a national crisis. Like we...
And so specifically, like the violence against women you speak of, like, you know, the numbers around domestic violence, which are a... If it were, I mean, look at the panic that we're in around the coronavirus at the moment.
Right.
Right?
Right.
People, we've shut down people coming from China. The tourism industry shut down. People aren't going out in Chinatown. And yet, you know, in Australia, I don't think there's been a death from the coronavirus. And there's, what, two women killed at the hands of a man they know, you know, per week in this country. So which is the real crisis, you know?
Yeah.
Where are the, where are the headlines? It is... We are starting to see some, you know, greater awareness of it. I mean, in my lifetime, and you would have seen this as well, like, you know, particularly working in the media, you know, there was a time, you know, 20, 30 years ago where domestic violence was barely even, like the cops were, you know, it was just, you know, it was just a domestic.
Yeah, it was a situation.
Yeah, it was it wasn't even considered to be a crime. Now we're seeing, I mean, but it is... an incredible epidemic that we are in the middle of, and the fact that we haven't just downed tools and, you know, are only concentrating on that at the moment shows just how little, you know, if it was two men a week, you know, dying in the same way.
Right. It's, I mean, and it's, I know it's a much bigger conversation around masculinity, but... Yeah, it's just so huge. And the fact that there's still funding that continues to be pulled from services that address DV. And it's like, we're just, what are we doing?
What are we doing? I mean, like, you know, and this is not to diminish the one punch thing, because that's also an important cause. Yeah. But, you know, a kid gets, king hit in the cross and dies, and we bring in a new law.
Yeah.
But, you know, women are, you know, dying at the hands of, you know, people who purport to love them, or at least, you know them, you know, at least a couple a week. You
know. Are these conversations that you have with other men and, like, with peers? Because I know that my partner struggles.
I think about this a lot, because the classic thing to say would be, I don't know anybody who is domestically violent to their partner. Mm-hmm. And I would hate to think that anybody I know is domestically violent to their partner. But the statistics suggest that I know at least someone who is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my circles, I think that we probably do police, you know, you wouldn't end up hanging out with the guy who's being, you know, overly aggressive to the girlfriend, or even speak about the, you know, the partner in those sort of terms and ways.
So but, would you pull him up in conversation?
Well, funnily enough, what ends up happening is that things become in their bubbles, right? You end up just not being friends with that person anymore, or they get excluded from, and, you know, particularly in, you know, my world, where you can quite easily choose your, it's not like you suddenly get stuck in a work situation where you might have a whole bunch of friends that you, you know, might not be from your world or your worldview and these sort of things. Like, sometimes I bet I can be guilty of overlooking these things because I've surrounded myself with people who, you know, probably share similar values to me. And,
yes.
And, you know, you end up being in this world where you think these things don't exist. You're like, you know, I don't see racism that often. I don't see, I'm in the arts. I'm like, I'm surrounded by, you know people of different colours and shapes and sizes and sexualities. Like, you know, it doesn't seem as big a deal for you. As it does in the broader community, and sometimes, but again, I think sometimes the mistake we can make is to think that, right?
Yeah.
Because chances are, there's probably still somebody in that group that needs to hear it.
Yeah.
And you certainly, even just yourself, like, you know, the more you learn about, you know, what behaviors, you know, are intimidating and these sort of things. Like, I'm super aware of, like, in fact, one of the things that perhaps, without wanting to go into my relationship too much, is that we probably suffered at over the years is that, I haven't been good at having, like, a good argument. Because I'm so big, and because I speak for a living and I can be loud, I will always kind of err on the side of not being those things.
Yes.
Because I can imagine those things can be incredibly intimidating, you know, just in a purely a size and volume and, you know, these sort of ways.
Mm.
So probably in retrospect, you know, occasionally we probably could have done with a good argument or two over a few things that would have just solved that. And then, but I'd rather err on that side than the other side. But you can see how, like, you know, anger and violence and these sort of things can be within you. And you need to sometimes take some steps to moderate what is inherently within you.
Yeah.
Am I having these conversations with my friends? I think I tend to have them, like, you know, again, in an artificial constraint, which would be like we'd sit down and do this podcast or something and have a conversation around it.
Yeah.
Or we'd sit down and do my other podcasts and we'll talk about why we, you know, won't watch Harvey Weinstein movies anymore. Mm. And it might lead to a bigger conversation around the nature of power and dynamics and those sort of things. But I'm not sure that you're having that one where you're like, hey, Darren, you shouldn't say that to Sarah.
Yeah. You know? It's a really tough one. And I know my partner, who, you know, I just love and adore so much for all the obvious reasons, but his immense kindness. But I often think about how would he react if, you know, a work colleague or someone with in his social circle was behaving in a problematic way, because certainly with sisters, like, whoo, you step out of line, you will be dragged, you know, like we are. And I love that about my sisterhood, is that I've had to have some really awful and tough conversations and hear some really awful and tough things about my actions, my thoughts, my words, my behaviors, and just to be freaking better, you know? But, yeah, I think of my partner and I can't imagine him, for all his gentleness, kind of saying, hey, buddy, like, I, you know, and I've tried talking to him about it, but he's also not much of a talker. He's incredibly technical, you know, and he's amazing on that level. But I'm like, is this something, like, should the fellas be talking about this more? Or I'm just wondering, what's the massive change so that people, particularly in positions of power, will finally get it? Because I just feel like around masculinity at the moment, our so-called leaders are not getting it.
They're not getting it. And I think even in just having this conversation, because I try to, when somebody asks me a question on this podcast, I try to genuinely explore my thought. Like, I try to not just give you a pat answer that. I try to go, am I doing enough? And in having this conversation with you right now, I think that probably the answer is still no. Because I think what men often confuse for doing enough is not being those things. Like, you consider it to be enough that I, because I told you a story when you asked me about what I do, you know, and how I moderate my behavior and how I think about it myself. But probably what we're really saying is that is not enough. You know, it is not enough to just say, I am not doing these things, therefore I've done my bit, because it's still being done. And that still being done means, oh no, now I have to be that guy who's the, you know, the pain in the ass. I'm going to have to be the, you know, bring it up and have the uncomfortable conversations and do more, because, you know, this is a, you know, we did it for the bushfires. You know, we all get together for the bushfires. This is the bushfires. This is people dying. This is something that we're clearly, whatever we're doing right now isn't enough. So therefore, should I be challenged myself in this situation to go, clearly what you're doing is not enough. You should be doing more. I don't know what that more necessarily is, but
what it looks like.
What it looks like, but what is it? Is it how I speak? Like, because in, you know, for a lot of time as a communicator, you do it through your own prism of going, well, I'll try not to make jokes myself in that way or speak. I'll try to be understanding or, you know, have these conversations or, but maybe there's more. Maybe you have to actually be doing more than that, more than just, you know, allowing this space, because this is a bigger problem than...
It's so huge. And I mean, I don't know if we'll ever have the solution to it, but when I see the fellas' discomfort, and I'm talking purely about social media, and sometimes in real life, like just the inability in knowing how to tackle this enormous issue. And it's probably the same as race as well, like whether it is talking about the patriarchy or talking about white supremacy, like people just don't know how to kind of disassociate themselves to look for what the overall bigger solutions are, and just the discomfort around kind of naming things and thinking about it through your own experiences and people that you know. And I mean, I think we've all been very guilty of not speaking up when we should have at times in particular situations. But I know that even with my partner, he probably won't be aware of just little things. Like when I'm driving at night, I lock all the doors. When I'm walking, I will have my key between, you know, my two fingers to just have it ready there just in case. Like these are the kind of things that we're constantly thinking about. And there are particular, you know, ways home that I won't go because it's going to be a quiet, just like you're constantly thinking about this as a woman, just how to keep yourself safe constantly. And, you know, I'm someone who can be quite mouthy, but when a fella is going to say something quite gross to me, do I respond in that moment? And when I don't respond, like the rage that I carry around for weeks afterwards because I didn't speak up. And it just, it continues even into the workplace, like being empowered to just speak your truth is such a difficult thing for so many women. And it just, I mean, you look at what happened even with the Four Corners report on St. Kevin's, like this has been a heavy week. And then that awful case up in Brisbane with the three children and their mother. It's not unrelated. It's about control. It's about coercion. It's about, you know, and it's all tied in so much with masculinity. And you're just like, damn, how do we, where do we start the conversation? And what could, what are the tangible solutions which we can bring to the table, which can be actioned and will work? Like, how do we start shift? Because you're talking about shifting an entire culture.
So the shifting conversation of masculinity, I think, is something that is definitely happening. Like, not everywhere, but it's
movements
definitely
like
happening.
Me too,
and I certainly think that, you know, you know, in my lifetime, I've seen, you know, men go from, I mean, I grew up in the country where, you know, yeah, like, you know, it really, there was, you know, no sort of communication on levels of any outside experience really. And whereas like, you know, I'm now surrounded by men who feel very comfortable talking to each other and talking about much deeper things. And, you know, in the, some of the cases you're talking about, the murder of the family, I noticed that, you know, and it's taken years of campaigning, you know, like by people like Jane Gilmore, who's been on this show previously, and a whole bunch of other people who've reframed, you know, the way the media reports on these things, the headlines they use, the language around it, the idea of, you know, the, you know, there's no good bloke that, you know, ends up killing, you know, his family, you know. But we've seen those headlines and those stories being presented in that way for so many years that it just felt normal. And so it's taken those activists and those people, and that's why I thought Jane's work is just so powerful, because she was one of the first people who identified that that newspaper headline, that way that this is described, is very powerful to, you know, what soaks in culturally around what this incident was. And I noticed that a lot of the media coverage, not all of it, there was some backlash against some of it, but a lot of the media coverage actually was very blunt about, you know, what that person had done and the way that they had done it and, you know, what that meant that they were. And I was like, oh, well, that's changing. Again, it's not changing fast enough to save those lives. And it's not the thing that's going to save those lives. But I think that as part of the broader picture, I do see things changing. But but that's not enough when there's, you know,
people
dying.
No, you're 100% right. But, you know, like, I'm heartily encouraged. The one thing that I love about my kids' school is just the incredible parenting community. And I think of, you know, because it's a very important thing for me raising two little boys, that when they're feeling frustrated or sad or angry, like, we'll talk about, you know, what it is that's brought them to that point. And they need to name how they're feeling. That's a big thing for me as well. And also too, they need to work out solutions if it happens again, how they will move forward the next time. And what are things they can put into practice or put into place, you know, to hopefully avoid this situation reoccurring. But just having them being able to be aware of and manage their emotions is such a big thing for me. And I see that with so many parents who are holding, taking time, because especially my parents being migrants, they just needed to put food on the table, clothes on our back. They didn't have time to do the touchy-feely stuff with us as kids, and not even in a bad way, because we knew that they loved us. But mum and dad never said, and they will never say, I love you or I'm proud of you. You know, that's, but I know through their actions and their words. I mean, the thing is, that's so funny with many migrant parents, is they will brag about you to their friends and fam, but they will never tell you, you know. And it's funny how, like, I make sure that my boys know how extremely loved and valued they are and how valid their feelings are. And I think that's a big part that so many parents are trying to play in order to raise a better generation, to hopefully, you know, just calm down the chaos that is happening in our world at this current time. And
man, I could talk to you all day. This has been so much fun. I've loved it. I've still got a little bit to go, but we have to start finishing up. But I like to give people warning. There's just so many things that I wanted to explore that we're not going to get to. We'll have to do a part two at some stage if you will come back and join
me.
It has been great fun. I always ask people what you think happens when we die. Do you have a thought about what do you think happens when we die?
Do you know what? This is just so morbid. I think that, you know, like, it's that ashes to ashes, dust to dust thing. I don't think that there's any big fancy story that happens on the other side. I think, you know, we leave the earth, make way for new life to come through, and life goes on and continues.
And are you fine with that?
I'm totally fine with that. Like, I don't, you know, I'm exhausted enough in this lifetime. I don't need to
need another one. Yeah, no.
I don't need to continue work on the other side. I want a nap.
What would you like people to remember of you?
Hopefully that I'm a warm person. And I gave enough of a shit to want to make a change through my kids.
What's your biggest weakness? when
chocolate.
What sort of chocolate?
Lint balls.
Oh yeah.
Is there anything else?
I love all chocolate. I'm a real sweet tooth, but I like a lint ball. But lint balls
What color?
Oh no, I don't judge lint balls on color. It's small steps. Small steps as an Australian. We start with the lint balls. they can get a little rich after a while is the only thing I would say about a lint ball. Sometimes if I'm going to see something at Hamer Hall, you know, there's that lint shop downstairs at South Bank. There's a specialist lint shop there.
No, I did not.
Oh, did you not know that?
No.
Oh, so at South Bank, just where all the cafes are on the river.
I love I work at the ABC, but I don't know there's a lint
so,
shop.
Yeah, there's a specialist lint shop. So you can go in and get all the different coloured balls and, you know, just pick and mix, you know, like and the little chocolate bars, and they'll do your hot chocolate as well if you like a hot chocolate with the lint chocolate.
Is it terrible if after this I just bounce there instead of rushing home to the kids? I think I need that.
Well,
hot
go
chocolate.
Home with a big bag of chocolates. But yeah, so often if I'm going to see a show, I'll stop in there on the way through and grab myself a bag of lint balls, and then by about 2 hours into the show, I'm feeling sick because I've
Love
eaten
it.
About 12 different coloured lint balls. So good choice. I like that. That was good.
Nice. It'd be all red.
If
for
I'm
me.
Oh, okay, so all milk red chocolate, balls. Milk chocolate,
yes.
Red, yes,
yeah.
If you could live in Groundhog, have you ever seen the movie Groundhog Day?
Yes, a long time ago.
Yeah, okay. So the idea is, and it's based on a kind of the Buddhist notion originally anyway, but it's the idea of living the same day every day because you have to learn how to do something, but you get to do that by living the same day every day. Mm-hmm. So in that movie, Bill Murray, one of the things he learns how to do while he's, you know, doing the other stuff is he learns how to play piano really well because, of course, you can go to a piano lesson every day and so by the end of it is, you know, you can play the piano. So you're in Groundhog Day. You're living the same day, you know, every day for a while. What's the skill that you want to pick up while you're in there?
Do you know what? I've always harbored this incredible dream to be a bass player.
Oh.
Yeah, or a drummer. There's something about, like, drummers to me.
Yeah. Drumming's harder than bass playing. I'll offend some people by saying that, but I reckon you can pick up bass playing easier than drumming.
But when people drum and they sing as well, I'm just like, that's a superpower that I would love to possess, is to be able, because I've got a terrible voice and my sense of rhythm, like this whole notion about black people having a great sense of rhythm. Sister Girl does not.
Yeah.
We know our gifts in this lifetime. That is not mine. And that's fine. I'm fine with it. But if I could do my life over multiple times and be able to embed myself in a particular skill, drumming and singing would be it.
I saw this amazing YouTube clip last night. It was, I think it was French, but it's in a stadium and it's a whole bunch of bass guitarists and a whole bunch of guitarists and a whole bunch of drummers, right? So imagine like hundreds of drummers in one area, hundreds of bass players over here in one area, hundreds of guitar players over here, and they're all doing, and then a bunch of singers, right? But everybody sings as well. So anyway, it's this amazing clip of them doing Seven Nation Army by the White Stripes.
What?
So imagine all the drummers doing it together, all the bass players playing the riff together. Anyway, and there's a conductor in the middle. I don't know where it comes from. It just happened to pop up on YouTube last night. No, it's amazing. Speaking of things in a community, because that's the joy that comes off it, is all these people who've come together to play this song together in this stadium. I highly recommend people check it out.
Oh, my God. Are they doing that?
Okay, so we're nearly done. We're definitely nearly done. I need to. This is good. I like. I mean, it's great when the time flies by. Let's do plugs. I'll put plugs in at the top as well. But what can we tell people about in regard to you and where to find your work? And
so the art show on what friends refer to as the posh station on
RN.
Radio National. Yes.
It's
not RN anymore. It's now back to Radio National. Yes.
Well, it's RN in the words of my partner's dad and his partner who listened to nothing but RN. And
love
every
it.
Single, they think because I work at the, like, you know, for the ABC, I make a TV show for the ABC that I'm across everything that happens at the ABC.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Did you hear that documentary on RN? I'm like, no, I did not. I have shit to do.
Uncle Jack's book. Jack Charles, Born Again Blackfella, an amazing memoir, because Uncle's story is something that we all need to know about. And it's not stuff that happened centuries ago. It's still, the effects are still being felt today. Like the way it kind of crystallizes how colonization continues to impact people's lives and genocide. His story is a difficult one, but it's also a very beautiful one. So,
and last but not least, this is the question we always finish on. I have a time machine. I don't, for legal reasons, I should point that out. But if I did, this would be the deal. You have a return trip, mm-hmm. and you can go to any time in your life and change or observe it. Or you can go to any time in history. I prefer if it's about your life, is my personal preference. But if you don't want to go to a place in your life and change it, go to a place in history and change or observe it.
I would hop in that time machine and I would go back and I would sit with my boobos on that woven mat in our village, Matalau, in Rabaul, and I would record their stories about their lives. I would get their reflections and I would get their advice.
Done. There we go. That's the right sort of answer for that question. Thank you so much for doing this. I have had an absolute ball. We did not know each other before this.
No, and, I've had so much fun.
I really feel like we know each other. Like, you know, now I hope that we get to hang out some more and, you know, have, you know, more conversations going forward in the future.
Absolutely.
This has been so or much fun. Thank you. Well, I mean, both. Yeah. Like, I didn't mean we had to record them all. I just meant we can talk at the same time.
Let's chat. Thanks, Will.
Thank you.